Hi, this is Ebony, and I know this is unusual for me to talk before an interview, but I want to take this moment to share with you my 5-day energy cleanse challenge, which is coming up on April 18th. I am excited about this event because I have five special guests that have been on my podcast, and we are going to be live streaming throughout that week of April 18th, and they will be teaching us strategies on how we can calm our nervous systems, embrace our power or step into our power and attract abundance in our lives. I have the wonderful Noelle Anderson, who is a music therapist, and she will be teaching us how we can use music to heal. Jeff Harry is a play expert. He is going to teach us how to incorporate play in our lives to help us de-stress and cultivate joy. I have new intuitive and quantum energy coach Nicole Starbuck. She's also an author. She'll be teaching us how to embrace our intuition. Jacqueline Steele is another wonderful coach who will be teaching us how to have emotional freedom. And lastly, but not least, we have the wonderful psychotherapist Bridget Gaspard, and she will be teaching us how to get unstuck by enlisting our inner selves. She's also an author, and she wrote a book about how to get unstuck, how to enlist your inner selves to get unstuck. So I am super excited about this. And if you are interested in learning more information or are participating, then please sign up for my newsletter at zazo.com because as more information comes out, I will be using that as a main channel of communication and my Facebook group and Facebook page. My handle there is at Motivation to Heal, and my Facebook group is Energy Healing with Ebony. I'll have all this in the show notes, but yes, I'm excited. So I hope that you're having a wonderful week. We are starting a new month in this wonderful new season. And what a great way to start with today's guest, Shelly Najjar. She is a registered dietitian, nutritionist, and certified intuitive eating counselor. And we all eat. So this is something that touches all of our lives. I hope you enjoy the interview. Let's get started.
So who gets to tell you what you can and can't eat? Who gets to tell you which foods are allowed and not allowed?
Hi, I'm Ebony, and I believe that stories change lives, and everyone has a story worth telling. Sometimes, unfortunately, we let our self-doubt get in the way of us writing our stories and sharing our stories. So that's why I created Motivation to Write as a source of motivation and inspiration to help writers like you and me share our stories with the world. So I talk to the experts ranging from entrepreneurs to marketers to authors to therapists to psychologists who share their knowledge and their advice to help writers like you and me step into our full potential. Shelly Najjar is a registered dietitian, nutritionist, and a certified intuitive eating counselor who supports women to improve their health and wellness from a non-diet intuitive eating approach. Early in her career, Shelly recognized the need for a new approach to helping people manage their health. Instead of restricting diets, she embraced experimenting with diets and discovering what works for individuals. Okay, so Shelly, tell us, how did you step into this field of what would we say, nutrition, health?
So, I mean, way before, like before I got into exactly what my specialties are, it was an 8th grade science fair project. In 8th grade, I was trying to pick a science fair idea, and we were looking through those, like you got to go to the library and check out a real book, and it's a book of science fair experiments. And so I did one on vitamin C content in vegetables. And I remember thinking it was really exciting because we got to, use iodine, which is like has a label that says, "Oh, this is dangerous" on it. And I was like, "Wow, look at me. I'm like dangerous, right?" Anyway, it was a really fun experiment and a very fun experience because I was reading and again through the library checking out these books, right? All these nutrition textbooks and learning about how nutrition is connected to everything else that we do and, the basics of nutrition and how we eat and what foods have in them. And it was the first time I had really learned that in to that detail, right? Then I started doing like job shadows and looking into all these things because my dad had noticed that I was so interested in it. And he was like, why don't you see if there's jobs in this area, right? And found out that there's something called a registered dietitian, and job shadowed like 6 different people and started taking, you know, food science class in high school and really loved it. So that's what I picked to go into for my college degree. Mm-hmm. Did that, and then I passed my exam. I was a dietitian, and then I realized that I didn't like the job that I was in, which is, you know, pretty common, I think, for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. And so I was trying to figure out, like, no, what do I do? Because this is not what I expected it to be. This is not, you know, this is not as helpful as I thought I was going to be. Mm-hmm. I was really excited because, you know, it was connected to everything, right? That was one of the biggest things that got my attention at the beginning. And then I was working in the hospital, and in hospital nutrition, like, it's not for me. I'm really glad that we have dietitians who that's their passion and that's their joy, right? Mm-hmm. Definitely not mine. And the way that we were practicing nutrition and the way that I was taught to practice nutrition is very, very restrictive. It's very, like, you do this and then you will get better. But if you don't, that's your fault because you didn't follow this correctly, right? And you should have done more, but since you didn't, like, now you have to eat this way, which is like taking all the joy out of the food and making you eat foods that you're not familiar with, you don't like, you don't know how to cook, you know, all those things. And I was like, this is not helpful. And we'd see the same people over and over and over again. And again, they were still, you know, having the same problems because it's not just about the nutrition and it's not their fault a lot of times. And so no matter how hard we try to like fix them, it's not going to work that way. Right. And by telling somebody they can't eat something, like, what that's exactly what they're going to want to eat. So, I started finding out that, you know, this is not the right way to do things. There's a better way, which is way more health bringing, life giving. And so that's where I started to move into intuitive eating.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really, I like how it started in middle school with like a science project. Like, who knew?
Yeah.
Never know when some school, anything, assignment, paper, essay, math project, science project is going to lead to a career and then lead to entrepreneurship. Because did you start your own business?
I did, yes.
Yeah.
I have my private practice now.
Yeah, yeah. So after you have this epiphany that this the way that dietitians or nutrition is working is not really working, and you went into intuitive eating, what is that exactly?
Yeah, so the way I describe it is it's really that connection of what your body is saying, like the internal cues that your body's giving you. And matching them with what we know about nutrition science. So we're honoring our health. We're letting those nutrition science inform us, but not like rule us, right? We're not going to be driven by the rules, the should eats, those kinds of things. We're combining that with our knowledge of what's happening on the inside of us. And then, you know, keeping in mind like our schedule and things like that, because, you know, if you only saying like, oh, well, we're just going to eat when we're hungry. What happens if we're in the middle of this interview and you're like, well, I'm ravenously hungry right now, so goodbye, right? Like, you could do that, right? It's just not very practical. And so there's some practical pieces that we can bring into that and say like, well, if I know I have this interview, I might need to eat before, so I'm not ravenously hungry during the interview. And then I can eat after that. And so you can kind of plan around knowing your own signals, knowing, you know, it's nice to eat. It's very helpful to eat. Mm-hmm. So we can do those kinds of things and like combine them all. And so when I talk to clients, I explain it by using tongue, body, brain alignment language. Mm-hmm. So it's a framework that I developed because it's extremely helpful to explain very quickly to people. And I can explain it now if you want.
Yeah.
Okay. So tongue is the taste preferences in this moment, because taste can change over time. So taste preferences in this moment. Your body is what you are feeling right now and what you would like to feel after you eat, because satisfaction is not just about right now in this moment. Satisfaction is actually about the whole food experience, right? How does it make you feel even after you eat? Mm-hmm. And then the brain, so tongue, body, brain, the brain piece is our knowledge, our experience, the things that we bring into this present moment, about our patterns, about our schedule, about, you know, past preferences, past experiences that inform what we would like to do. And when we take all those three and we align them, we give them equal priority, then we can say, okay, I am eating with alignment. I am using intuitive eating, basically, is that same idea. Tongue, body, brain alignment, mm-hmm. is just a way of explaining intuitive eating in a practical sense. So mm-hmm. I have some examples, if that makes sense. If it's pretty clear already, I don't need to share them.
Well, yeah. So let me just kind of try to summarize what intuitive eating is. So you are taking into account your particular, the way your body functions. You're taking into account your dietary needs, and you're taking into account your lifestyle. And you're kind of meshing that all together to come up with like a custom eating lifestyle.
Plan. Yeah, that can change in the moment from moment to moment, right? Because I may really be hungry and know that, like, say I'm about to go on a date. Mm-hmm. I might be really hungry right now. Mm-hmm. But if I ate a meal because I'm hungry enough for a meal, if I ate a meal right now, then my date is not going to go quite as well as I anticipated it going, right? Because then we're eating this nice dinner, but I'm not going to be hungry for it. Right. Mm-hmm. So in order to enjoy that meal there, I can eat a snack now, knowing that I'm not going to be fully satisfied with my hunger. Right. Mm-hmm. But then I can eat later again and really enjoy that meal there and have my meal satisfaction at that point. And my, like, yes, I'm honoring my hunger still. Right. I'm responding to it. I'm not just saying like, well, I can't eat anything all day long because I'm about to go to dinner. That doesn't make any sense. Mm-hmm. So I'm honoring that hunger. And I'm using my brain to think about, like, okay, what is happening next, right? Mm-hmm. I know that this is something, or if I don't have time because I'm about to head into that meeting, maybe I eat, you know, just a snack at the beginning because I don't have time to eat a full meal or go get the food. This is the available food I have. So I eat that. And then after my meeting, I go and fully respond to my hunger needs, right? Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it sounds like it's really just a matter of being self-aware and also just aware of the day and you know, and planning. Because I actually do this. If I'm going out to dinner or lunch or whatever, I always first, I look at the menu at home. I always like to see exactly what's on and see what I'm going to eat. And then I plan accordingly. So if I know I'm going out to dinner and I see something on the menu that looks super good and it might be kind of rich in calories, I'll eat something very light for breakfast or lunch. And then go enjoy the dinner.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. And I, you know, it's even like, may I speak into that,
yeah.
that example? Yeah. So even for that example, right, if we think of, you know, letting your preferences play a role and letting that intuitive eating side come out even further, it's not being driven by those calories, right? Like at the beginning, you were driven by satisfaction. You said, I'm really excited about this thing. Right. Great. Let that drive it, because satisfaction is more than just like pleasure in that moment, right? Satisfaction is like, wow, I'm going to really enjoy this. And I know I'm going to feel really good afterwards. It's going to be so great. I don't want to, like, you know, ruin my appetite to, mm-hmm. to not enjoy this thing. So I'm going to just eat something small and then I'm going to go. Not saying so much about the calories part of it, because when we talk about calories, if we talk about it really neutrally, right, it's a fact. There's energy in foods, right? That's what calories are. They're just a measure of energy. However, a lot of times what happens is we bring that in as a judgment or as something that says, like, this is a less good of a food for us, morally speaking, right? Like, it's not that it's going to taste great, that the taste is up here, but the moral judgment, right? The moral judgment we have, like, that's less good. It's sinful. It's bad, right? Mm-hmm. Those kinds of languages we use. Oh, it's like, it's really rich and indulgent and things like that. Like, okay, it can be really rich. It can be really satisfying, and that's okay. Mm-hmm. Like, there's nothing wrong with enjoying our food.
Right.
Food is just neutral. So having those calories, they're like, yeah, it's a measure of energy, right? Mm-hmm. Just a measure of energy. And when we say like, oh, so I'm going to have something really high in calories, And so maybe I'm going to eat less calories now. That's no longer using your intuition, your intuitive eating, the full alignment. You're using your brain only, and particularly the judgment part of your brain that's saying, I have to make up for these calories ahead of time. I have to earn them. I have to eat less now so that I can eat more later. Right. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So that's that piece is like, it's really sneaky because we just like swimming in this water all the time. Right.
Right. Right. Right.
Yeah.
So we shouldn't be thinking in terms of calories. We should be thinking in terms of enjoyment.
Yeah. Yeah. If we bring it back to satisfaction, mm-hmm. That's one of the principles of intuitive eating. There's 10 principles. And I can send a link afterwards from the intuitive eating website that talks about the 10 principles. But those 10 principles, one of them is seeking satisfaction. Mm-hmm. Because when we seek satisfaction, we're more likely to meet our health, like the recommended health goals anyway, like the way that we eat. We want variety, right? Yes.
Right.
If you ate the same food every day, for every meal and every snack, that would not be satisfying. So naturally, your satisfaction is already going to drive you toward variety.
Uh-huh.
We actually get like more dopamine pleasure from variety of foods. And so when you think about that, right, more variety in our foods is linked to better health outcomes. So there's a lot of different examples of that. Like, you know, people say like, oh, well, if I just ate whatever I wanted, it wouldn't be satisfying. It's not whatever you want in that moment, like the pleasure aspect. It's thinking again about satisfaction. What is going to satisfy now and what is going to satisfy later? After you finish eating, are you still going to be comfortable? Are you still going to be, you know, satisfied with that meal experience? Because our meal doesn't end after we put the last bite in our mouth, right? Mm-hmm. There's still like, then we digest and we think about the meal and all those kinds of things, right? We can have the best meal ever. You can go to that restaurant. If you're arguing with people and you have to eat it really fast because the waiter's standing there going, we need your table, it's not going to be a satisfying experience, right? There's many things that go into that idea of satisfaction.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So, I mean, what if, because sometimes I might be doing this. If I want like a brownie and then I have like the option of a banana, I'll eat the brownie because I know that if I eat the banana, it's not going to satisfy me. I'm just going to eat more of something to try and get the satisfaction that I would have gotten. I might even just eat the brownie also, or more brownies.
Right. Right.
Okay. Yeah. So it's really listening to your body and what will satisfy you in this moment. And you're taking also into account of how you will feel afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay.
Yeah, because like if you say the brownies, right? Say you were like, wow, I really want this brownie. And so you ate it and it was wonderful. And you're like, I really want another one. And you ate it and the first bite was still pretty good. And you keep eating and you're like, okay, it's less good. But like this brownie, it still tastes pretty good. Like it's still amazing. And maybe not as amazing at the beginning, but it's amazing. And so you eat like four of them or five of them or however many it takes for you to feel like, yeah, that was really good. But afterwards, you might not feel so good in your body, right?
Right. Yeah.
So
yeah.
That's the thing is like, if, you know, however many less brownies make you still feel okay in your body, right? Still feel satisfied in your body, then the more satisfying experience would be to eat fewer brownies. But it doesn't necessarily mean you have to eat less brownies every time you sit down, right? We can always have this idea of what is satisfying, what is the most satisfying. And it's just information. So we could decide something different, right? Mm-hmm. When I talk to people about like, you know, sometimes it's not even about the food. Sometimes it's like, oh, I'm feeling a certain way and I want that brownie. And so I'll eat a brownie. And what I really want, it's my grandmother's brownie recipe or something, right? And so then I want to remember her because I'm feeling kind of lonely and I want that comfort that comes from that memory. And I want, you know, all this, the connection and all of those things that bring in, you know, I remember like we used to make it and all that. I don't know. I never make brownies with my grandma, but you know, like those, that kind of idea. And like a lot of people have those memories associated with food or something else, right? It's, a lot of times it's like not the food. But when we do that, the most nourishing thing, maybe a brownie, maybe look through some pictures of my grandma and, you know, whatever it is. And you can still know all that. And you can be, I'm going to eat the whole thing of brownies, right? The whole plate. I'm just going to eat it all. Because it doesn't mandate a response. Just knowing the information about what might be the most satisfying doesn't mandate a response, because otherwise that becomes another rule where we follow it just like another diet, and then it becomes another diet and we're right back where we started. So
then if you eat like the whole plate of brownies and then you feel horrible afterwards, then you know, you learn from that and you know, okay, next time I'm just going to, if I eat like 10 brownies, didn't really work for me, so I'll just try 8 next time or whatever, right?
Yeah. It's all an experimentation too.
Yeah, that's what it sounds like. So then, I mean, you brought up kind of the emotional aspect of eating, which I think is huge for people. I know it is for me, because whenever I feel stressed, I want sugar. And sugar is really, I mean, it's a huge addiction for everyone. I don't say everyone, but for a lot of people. I actually was listening to this interview with a dentist, a holistic dentist. And first of all, I didn't know that every tooth was linked to an organ in the body. I was just blown away when I learned that. And then she talked about like the worst thing for your teeth is sugar. But sugar is such, it's harder to beat sugar than it is to beat heroin, she says. And I kind of believe it, because there's sugar in almost everything, right? But I feel like it's an emotional pull for a lot of people. When I grew up, I ate a lot of sugar. My family, we loved our fast food and our junk food. And then that kind of just, and so if when you become an adult and you recognize these patterns that have been happening since your childhood, how do you begin to break some of that to live a healthier and eat just healthier when it's so ingrained in you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So thanks for sharing that story too, because I know that, like, you know, anytime we get personal, it's like, oh, you just shared that moment with me, and that was really special. So thank you for doing that. It's very common, right? A lot of people, whether they've started when they were younger or when they, you know, developed a taste for sugar later on, it's something that as a culture we can say, like, wow, we're addicted. Mm-hmm. And the pull toward it, like you said, the pull toward it is so real, right? Mm-hmm. Sugar addiction is not real. Sugar addiction doesn't have the research to support it. And there might be people who are like, well, what about those studies? Okay. So there's many studies. I could get into a lot of things. I recently taught a class on this. I should re-record it so that it's like permanent. And if that is the case, then I'll send you the link so that you can put it with this. But I think when we're talking about breaking a learned behavior around a food, right, or breaking that pull toward a food, the relational pull toward a food, because it's about how we're interacting with that food, right? So it's a relationship. So mm-hmm. if you've grown up, or you've, you know, started a relationship with somebody, I mean, we all know how it can be very, very difficult to change the pattern of that relationship, right? The way that we think about that person, the way that we're interacting with them, like we fall into these patterns of behaviors around that person. It's the same thing with our food. We can have a relationship with our food that doesn't serve us well. And when we set up this dichotomy of a good foods or bad foods, and it doesn't necessarily look like sugar is bad, everything else is good, right? It might look like when I eat sweets, I am not being a healthy eater. I am not doing the right thing. I'm not eating the right thing. I have to make this up. I have to exercise more. I have to not eat this thing, or I have to only eat salads, right? Like those kinds of thinking, it's still that same boil down. It's still this good, bad thinking. Mm-hmm. And when we start changing that thinking, this the way that we relate to our foods, then everything else kind of calms down, right? It's like going into that relationship with a person, thinking that they're a horrible person, you're going to interact with them differently than you are if you just figure out and like discover them for who they are at that moment, right? Mm-hmm. Or you come to it with a neutral approach. So with sugar, if we come to it with a neutral approach where we just say it's food, it's another food, it takes down some of that, the drive for sugar. If we have access to it, the continued access to it, not that we have to eat it every time, but that we could, right? That it's not the last time that we can get sugar. This is the only time that we can have it. Then it takes down that dopamine response as well. And there's less of a pull because there's less of a reward for it. Sugar itself, one of the biggest things is like sugar can't be addicting, because otherwise we'd be addicted to other foods too, like, you know, broccoli and I don't know, fruit and all these other foods that become sugar in our bodies. Like glucose is a big sugar in our bodies, not like big size, but like a primary sugar in our bodies, because that's what our body's cells use for fuel. And the food that we eat, a lot of it gets broken down into glucose, sugar. So it's not about sugar is evil or sugar is addicting. It's that in humans, we don't have that research to support it. It's more of that psychological draw toward the food, the emotional pull, like you were talking about. When I say don't think about sugar or don't think about the purple elephant, this is the example I always use. Don't think about a purple elephant. What do you instantly think about? Mm-hmm. A purple elephant, right? Like nobody was just randomly thinking about a purple elephant right before I said that. So it's that same idea. We've just set up something that now requires you to use discipline and energy to not do. So in order to meet my goal, I have to now expend energy doing the right thing or feel like a failure, right? That's the only two options if I'm setting up that goal, because I never had to have that goal in the first place. My goal doesn't have to be reduce sugar or stay away from sugar or break that addiction. My goal can be, I'm going to neutralize my relationship with sugar. Mm-hmm. Because that's different. That's more gentle. That's more compassionate. So if I want sugar, there's nothing bad or wrong with me, right? If I decide not to eat it, I'm not getting, you know, award points for doing that. I'm just choosing a different food. I'm just choosing a different experience. I'm just choosing a different way of relating with sugar and other foods like that. And so I think one of the biggest things, like when we're talking about changing those, like the patterns that we've been taught and passed down, I mean, and it can be like generations, right? Like you think about how many foods and families are connected over that, like maybe a shared like criticism of your body, for example, mm-hmm. right? Or an experience where everybody eats and then everybody diets starting the next day or something like that. Like these things that we've learned about how we interact with our foods and our bodies, we have to learn new patterns, new ways of interacting in order to move past that, right? And some of it, we have to identify what is happening. So when you think about like, ooh, I'm recognizing the thought that sugar is addicting, you say, where did I get this thought from? Right? Who decides that sugar is addicting? Who decides how much sugar I can have? Who decides that I am not good at, like, I'm not good to eat when I eat sugar, or I'm not good enough to be able to eat sugar? Like sometimes people say, well, she can eat sugar, but you know, for someone like me, I can't eat sugar. Who decides that? Like, let's take back some of that power and decision-making and have some agency around these things so that we have more, you know, it's talking about that like self-empowerment idea, right? Like let's decide some things in our own lives, whether, you know, not letting other people decide so many of them for us.
So then what is that feeling, Shelley, when I go through most of the day without having something sweet and I'm feeling like I'm just craving it and kind of feeling agitated and like I need sugar. What do you call that?
Yeah, sometimes I call it hunger. If we're not eating enough, we're going to want sugar because it's, again, that primary draw, right? So if we need to raise our blood sugar, our blood glucose quickly, we're going to want, through a learned experience of which foods contain something sweet, right? Which ones have the sugar in them, we're going to want that more. So if you have a lot of carbohydrate cravings, if you have a lot of sugar cravings, one of the big things I check for, if you're my client, is are you eating enough food? And then the second thing I check for is, are you eating enough carbohydrates? Because if we don't have enough carbohydrates, we're still going to want them from somewhere. So sugar is really fast to get those carbohydrates, to get our blood sugar back up into a normal range, right? The third thing is, do you have a restriction around sugar? Whether it's like physically, you're not allowing yourself to eat it, or mentally, I can only have so much of this, or this is a really bad food and I feel really miserable when I don't have it, or I'm trying to push that sugar craving back. Finally, I eat it at the end of the night and I eat the whole plate of brownies again, right? Versus like, or trading it off. Like, well, if I want something sweet, I can have that banana instead of the brownie. Why not have the brownie, right? There's nothing wrong with having the brownie. Mm-hmm. If that's what you really want, let's have the brownie. Mm-hmm. Eat it so that you're satisfied. If you notice that every time you have brownies, you eat the whole tray and that's how much it takes to get satisfied, we can get curious around that too, right? Like But I think neutrality is important to bring in. Neutrality, curiosity, that sense of experiment, and the sense of self-compassion. Like, let's be kind to ourselves. When we eat the whole plate of brownies, it's not the end of the world, right? Eventually you will feel better. Eventually you will feel hungry again, right? If you eat more food, maybe it's not sugar, maybe it's something else. And again, now you're feeling like very, very uncomfortable. Eventually you will get hungry again. Eventually you will feel comfortable again. It won't last forever. It will pass. Like literally when we're talking about food, it will pass. Right. So, you know, when we're doing all these things, when we're saying like, why do I feel this way? Why do I feel so out of control? If it's not addicting, I'm not sure if you can hear that, but there's a ton of noise outside. If it's not addicting, then why do I feel like I must have it? Sometimes it's because you're saying you must not have it. Or sometimes you're saying I can only eat so much and you're not eating to full satisfaction where you feel comfortably full. Then if you don't do that, your body's always going to be looking for something else because it wants to eat, right? Like, so let's honor our hunger and our fullness. But let's say like, we don't have to stop eating once we're just not hungry. We can actually go beyond that a little bit to comfortable fullness. And we can say, hey, I'm going to be eating to comfortable fullness where I'm satisfied and I feel comfortable and I'm ready to go on to the next thing. And I'm not constantly thinking about foods anymore. And the more that we restrict our foods, the more we think about them. So the more that we're saying like, okay, let's try to eat less sugar. Uh-huh. We tend to eat more sugar right. in general.
Yeah. Right. So if I'm understanding you correctly, it's not a matter of restricting particular foods. It's a matter of eating and then being aware of how that food settles with your body, how you feel after you've eaten the food. And then if you notice that you don't feel good physically in your body after having eaten, and I'm not talking about like allergic reactions, obviously you probably don't want to eat peanuts if you're allergic to peanuts, but I mean just you feel like, ugh, after you've eaten, I don't know, a BLT or whatever, maybe one too many BLTs, then you recognize that and you say to yourself, okay, it's not that I'm going to stop eating BLTs. It's just, I'm not going to eat as many as I had that last time because, and it could be many reasons why you did. Perhaps you did feel super hungry or maybe you were feeling stressed, but I'm just going to be more aware of how this food is making me feel so that I can make the right choice for my body next time. Not, I'm going to completely cut this out or back down from eating.
Right, right. Okay. And to know that it's moment by moment. So right then, like you said, maybe you were really hungry. And so you ate like many more BLTs than you maybe would have in a normal day. But say now, then you said, oh, well, at the 2 point, I was like satisfied. And the third one, I didn't, you know, I don't know. Mm-hmm. And so then the next time around, just saying like, well, I have a 2 BLT limit. That's not really checking in, right? That's just making a new rule based off of a previous experience. Mm-hmm. So we would say again, like, how hungry do I feel right now? What do I want to eat? And say it's BLTs again. You say, okay, how hungry, how many BLTs would satisfy right now?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah.
And it might be like 1.5. It might be 3 if you hadn't eaten anything, right. You know, but if you just ate before, it might be like 1 bite, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. So then what is healthy eating? Is there a such thing as... Because when we think of healthy eating, we think of eating mostly fruits and vegetables and, you know, the whole grains and not eating a lot of packaged food or processed food or fast food. Is there a such thing as healthy eating as far as content, or is healthy eating the intuitive eating?
Yes. So it's the way that we approach, right? Having that healthy relationship with our foods, mm-hmm. eating normally without that sense of restriction, mm-hmm. And also that aspect of gentle nutrition. So intuitive eating is not ignoring nutrition science, right? Mm-hmm. But the things that we know about nutrition science are really from a population level. So how do we bring that population data to the personal? That's the sense of gentle nutrition, is we take that nutrition science and we interpret it through the lens of what is happening in the person's context, right? Mm-hmm. And that body and saying like, okay, if you don't like kale, like I rarely like kale. If you don't like kale, then okay, would you take it and say, well, kale is a cruciferous and it's really, you know, full of these, you know, minerals and these vitamins and it's great fiber. And so you must eat kale now. No, I don't have to, right? It's not something that I really like. And there's other sources of those foods. Mm-hmm. So you can find those nutrients, like variety, like I was talking about earlier, variety is really important. And we get more variety when we're seeking satisfaction. When we're eating intuitively, we meet the nutrition requirements more than people who are trying to meet the nutrition requirements. Mm-hmm. There's a growing body of research that says the more that we eat using intuitive eating principles, the more that we meet those nutrition requirements, the better our health looks, the better our labs look. So it's not that we're ignoring nutrition science. It's not that we're saying there's no healthy way to eat, that there are foods that are beneficial. There are foods that give us nutrients, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Eating in a way that is intuitive is helpful for that, is helpful for reaching those goals. And it includes a variety of foods, includes, you know, many fruits and vegetables. It includes balanced meals, you know, having those, the carbohydrates, the fats, the proteins, you know, all in this mix and having them from a lot of different sources if you're able to. It involves eating enough food, right? And so whether that's just because we're allowing ourselves to eat or because we've figured out ways that work in our environment or with our budget and things like that, right? Is to have this awareness of more than just like, well, everybody should eat this prescriptive set of foods, because that doesn't make sense culturally. It doesn't make sense financially for a lot of people. It doesn't make sense even just to say like no processed foods, right? I mean, that like there's a time saver there. There's even some of the processed foods, depending on what kind of processing we're talking about, right? Like there's many different nuances there. And so that's why I say, like, if you just focus on like intuitive eating and that tongue, body, brain alignment, and then bring it, once you have that mindset down, the new mindset, the new relationship with food, then we bring in the gentle nutrition in a way that is still not rules based, still honoring your own preferences, still honoring your own experience, and just bringing that in where it's fitting. That's where healthy eating is, right? It's that combination of it, but using that groundwork of that healthy relationship to start with.
Yeah. So I can already hear people, because, you know, I work with high school kids and their idea of eating well, I guess, is like, you know, a bag of chips for breakfast, candy, snack on candy, and then another bag of chips for lunch, and then you go to the burger joint after school. And I mean, I'm sure that's very satisfying for them. What do you say to people who are like, okay, but this, how I'm eating is very satisfying, but yet they're not getting the good stuff. I mean, I don't even know if there's a such thing as good or bad with the intuitive eating, but like the fruits and the nutritious stuff, Shelley, how do you get them? Or does the education come with intuitive eating? It kind of sounds like maybe the hope is that you will learn to listen to your body. And so if you know your body's saying, I need more of the fruits and vegetables, you'll listen.
Yeah. I mean, there's some, you know, just like in a lot of coaching and a lot of processes of self-discovery, right? Like we bring that mindfulness and then we check in with ourselves and we need to learn how to do that process. And we need to learn how to, or relearn. And in the case of intuitive eating, it's really a process of relearning. Uh-huh. Because we're born with a lot of these skills and it gets taught out of us for whatever reason. So like maybe the high schoolers, it's a matter of finances. It's a matter of convenience. Uh-huh. It's a matter of peer pressure, right? There's a lot of already pressures around body size and image and things like that. And what, you know, what do different people eat? You know, maybe it's like there's a status type of thing, or maybe there's, you know, something else going on there. Maybe because you value something over another thing, right? Because there's a process of values here. And if we value the social connection and not having to go get food, or, you know, you're doing something and food maybe keeps you from doing that particular activity at that particular time, of course you're going to choose something that allows you to do that because this is where your value is, not over here, right? Mm-hmm. So sometimes it's about connecting, you know, your health with your values. So if you eat a certain way, does it give you more energy to do the things you want to do? if you are trying to study really hard and you only have a bag of chips because you don't want to break from that study, or, you know, for adults for work or something like that, you will actually be able to study better. You'll have more energy. You'll have more thinking power when you fuel your body more, right? So then we can angle it that way. You know, it's connecting with, again, what is that person's context? What do they value? What do they find appealing and engaging, and what do they want? And it doesn't always have to be nutrition, right? I think that's the other piece, is like, if somebody doesn't want to change, if somebody doesn't value that, that's okay too. Mm-hmm. It's not my place to tell them to value it more. Mm-hmm. We all have to come to that place on our own. And sometimes, yes, it's about the education. If you really value something and you're like, can't do it because the nutrition piece is missing, like, okay, here's something that could help you do this better, or easier, or whatever it is, right? But if you are happy with the way that things are, there's much less incentive to change anything regarding eating, right? Mm-hmm. And at the same time, like, assuming that somebody did want to change, or assuming that, you know, there was just that idea of like, how can we improve the nutrition status for this situation? Some of it is making the other foods accessible and, you know, convenient, or whatever the pieces are. Some of it is about making it appealing. So if you only have, like, say in a school cafeteria, you only have like mushy, oversteamed vegetables, that's not appealing. Nobody wants to eat those, right? Mm-hmm. So let's find out what are the preferences, because there's many ways to eat fruits and vegetables, right? And over time, people will like fruits and vegetables, or at least they won't dislike all of them, right? Yeah. So sometimes it's not so much about, like, this is where the gentle nutrition side of things comes in. Sometimes it's not about, I only want to eat things that are pleasurable, right? The difference between pleasure and satisfaction, again, pleasure is in the moment. Satisfaction takes into consideration a much broader perspective on time. And like the environment and all those other things, right? So if I'm saying I want to have, you know, better body function or something like that, and eating fruits and vegetables is a way to get there, just pretend I hate all kinds of fruits and vegetables. Then we can work together to figure out which ones are less offensive to my taste buds, or in what ways are they less offensive to my taste buds, so that I can still eat them. It's not displeasurable. It's not dissatisfying or unsatisfying or whatever that word is. It's just not totally the most satisfying experience. So how do I make the total experience more satisfying? I eat it with other things, right? Like, mm-hmm. Okay, say I really like cheese, but I don't really like vegetables. Can I put the cheese on the vegetables, or can I eat the vegetables and have the cheese in the same meal, so that I feel like there are some parts that are very satisfying and some parts that are not? Yeah. Assuming that you have the right relationship with food already, because otherwise it just becomes you must eat the vegetables in order to eat this other thing, right?
Okay. Yeah. So then I can already tell we're just going to go over time. That's okay. I'll just maybe make this into two episodes. But so, because this is huge, I think this is a huge topic, because we have a lot of health problems. We have obesity is huge. There's heart disease. There's people walking around fatigued and stressed. And I'm sure that what we're eating has a lot to do with the way our bodies are functioning. Someone posted, this was about a year ago or so, someone posted on Instagram a message or something that said, it was like around Thanksgiving, and this particular poster is obese. And she said, it's Thanksgiving time, and you know, you should just eat as much as we want. Don't let people tell you not to eat, whatever. And she got a lot of, what's the word? Like, there were people that were a little upset. Like, yeah. You know, what do you mean? Someone in your condition, this isn't even healthy to have this type of thinking, because in your condition, perhaps you need to think about cutting back. So, I mean, we have all these perceptions about food and what's good and what's bad, and then the way that it's affecting us. And people just are very judgmental, as you said, about what we're putting in our bodies and what we should not be putting on our bodies, but we don't really pay attention to satisfaction versus pleasure. I feel like a lot of us in the moment are in it for the pleasure, but not really paying attention to the satisfaction part of it. And you mentioned right now that we need to first have a relationship with food, but how, and I know you probably have said this and maybe it just slipped by me, but how, what's the practical first step in having a healthy relationship with food? Like, how do you sit someone down and say, okay, well, let's start to change that. Like practically, what do you do?
Yeah. So, I mean, there's a lot there in your example that you shared and in just this, like the practical first step. So I'll answer your question first. So the first thing I usually do is we talk about kind of my philosophy around like nutrition and weight, and health at every size. And so I'll pick those up in a second because I think it's related to your example. But the first thing that the practical first step would be to experiment with an all foods fit mentality. What I mean by that is allowing yourself to eat and allowing yourself to eat all foods unconditionally. It's unconditional permission to eat and unconditional permission to eat all foods. And that can feel really scary and it can feel really like I'm, you know, committing nutrition heresy. And people get really upset even just by saying that. Mm-hmm. And it's like what we've been talking about, right? If you think that you can only have so much sugar, like, oh yeah, it's allowed, but only like after a meal in this particular amount, mm-hmm. that's still a restriction, right? You're still not allowing yourself unconditional permission to eat. If you say I can eat as much as I deem as satisfying or that I would want, or just to experiment, I want to eat the whole thing just because, even if it's not satisfying, just to prove to myself that I can, like I really don't have any restrictions. And then you say, well, now I have to go work out for 3 days. That's still restriction, right? Like you still have to make up for it. It's not unconditional. There's still conditions. You can only have it if you blah, blah, blah. We don't have to earn our foods. We don't have to make up for our foods. Food is a basic human right. It's a human need. We don't have to deny ourselves that right. We don't have to deny ourselves that need, right? So I start there. Let's just experiment with what would happen if you did this. Okay. So really we just say, okay, if you're up for it, let's just experiment like in the next 1 to 2 weeks, or even just like the next meal, if that's too scary for some people, like it really depends on the person, right? But just say they're going to experiment with this. And then I just have them observe, like pay attention neutrally. What happens? What did you feel? Were you able to do this, or was it really, really challenging? And usually what happens is people identify a lot of noise that comes up in their heads, right? Voices from themselves, voices from other people that they've heard, comments, things that they've learned, things that they've heard from the medical community, things that they heard from, you know, childhood teasing, mm-hmm. you know, the relationship that we're taught as a kid, all of those things, right? Magazines, everything. And you bring that all in and we say, okay, so who gets to tell you what you can and can't eat? Who gets to tell you which foods are allowed and not allowed? And what do you want to do about that? And we just start exploring, right? With what is, it's an information gathering essentially. And that practice of allowing ourselves to eat and allowing ourselves to eat unconditionally and to give ourselves that experience so we can realize that, yes, maybe there is an initial like, oh my gosh, I'm going to eat it all. And I feel really out of control. And the more that you just say, I'm going to not respond to it by clamping down that control again, but to say, okay, I'm going to hold gentleness for that. Like, I understand that I might feel more out of control because I haven't, like now I'm testing it, right? That's like a little kid. They're going to test those boundaries. And if I suddenly say, I don't have boundaries for what I can and can't eat anymore, I'm going to say like, it's okay. It's okay that I'm going to eat this. It's okay that I want this. It's okay that I enjoy my food. Mm-hmm. And it's okay that I feel out of control sometimes. It's okay that I ate more than I was comfortable with. It's okay that food is a little scary, I realize, or that, you know, food is exhausting. Like I've been thinking about food, you know, I have to plan everything. I have to think about what is allowed and not allowed. I'm tired of counting it. I'm tired of doing all these things. And when you have a chance to realize what is happening or, you know, what could be happening, I think that's a great place to start because you're gathering so much information and then we can kind of unpack that as we go through and we can see how that shifts. We uh-huh. can see where it needs to shift, right?
Mm-hmm. So if you start with the self-compassion, And then once you start to have compassion for what you want to eat and how you feel and your eating habits, then that just helps you to relax. And once you're relaxed, then that's when a mind shift begins to happen. Right. Mm-hmm. I feel like that's really what it is, because when you're stressed out, or when you have all these restrictions about what I can't eat and what I can eat, what I've been told I can or cannot eat, what people have told me that I eat too much of this or that, then that just causes stress. And then the stresses cause chemical reactions in our bodies, which cause the cravings for all the stuff that we are told that we shouldn't be eating. But if you begin to just relax, that has a different chemical reaction, which now just helps you to feel a little bit more empowered and in control and happier, so that now you can start making decisions that you want to make that empower you.
Right, right. Okay. Yeah.
Okay. That makes sense. I'm starting to understand. It's taking me an hour. I'm starting to understand.
It's okay. You know, I work with people for months and months and months, right? So like this is a lifelong process, really. And, you know, just getting, you said like, oh, it's finally taking me, like, yeah, it's going to take a little bit to adjust our mindset to learn this new way of thinking, to hear these things and not like bristle up at them and say like, whoa, no, that is not true, right? But like, how do we know that's not true, right? Like, we're just accepting the things that we're hearing as true because we've heard them so many times, but it doesn't mean that that's true. It doesn't mean that it's evidence, you know, we have research studies for that. Like, even if I might redirect us back to the example that you were sharing about the social media person, and she was getting all that flack for saying it.
Mm-hmm.
So there's even this concept of obesity and overweight are actually like they're medicalized terms for something that is not a medical problem. Mm-hmm. It's variety in human bodies, right? And some of that is, and I'm sure you're like, some of your listeners should be like all, you know, reacting to the statement. So I will explain a little bit more, but being in a bigger body does not mean that you are not healthy. We come in a variety of shapes and sizes. And part of the history of human health science and medical things is that we were trying historically to try to make people a certain size and shape because we felt like that was the normal.
Mm-hmm.
There's not a lot of evidence to say that human bodies should only come in a certain size and shape.
Mm-hmm.
There's more evidence to say that we have a variety of size and shape, just like we have a variety of hair textures and hair colors and eye colors and frame size and all of these other things. And to just think really hard and hope that they change isn't going to change them, right? Mm-hmm. Like, we can dye our hair, we can try to straighten it. And I have curly hair normally. So like, you know, as somebody with curly hair, like, I know when I get in the shower and I come back out of the shower, when I go outside and it's humid outside, it's still going to be curly, right? Like, there's nothing that I can do that, like, in my, like, as it grows out of my head, it's still not going to be curly. You know, there are things that can affect it, but like, if I'm just trying really hard, like, it's not going to not be curly, because that's how it's made, is it's curly, it's coming out and it's curly, right? Mm-hmm. I have curls. If I was just, and for a while, like, I didn't want them. I wanted to have it straight. And I didn't understand this concept. Like, as a little kid, I didn't have like super curly hair when I was younger. And there were like three other kids who had kind of the same haircut as me. And I thought if I just brushed it really hard, because that's what I asked another girl, how do you get your hair like that? And she says, oh, I just brush it with a little water. And so I tried at home to brush it with a little water. And all it kept doing was getting curlier and curlier and frizzier and frizzier. And it's the same idea. Like, if I'm doing something that my body will never do by itself, it's just going to make the problem worse, right? Problem meaning defined by that criteria, right? Like, if I said my hair is supposed to be straight and now it's a problem that it's not, I'm trying the things that are supposed to make it straight, it's going to make the problem worse because it's not actually making it straight, right?
Mm-hmm.
The thing is, it's never a problem. That the curly hair was not a problem. It was just the way it was. Right. And it just means that my hair is different than that other girl's hair.
Mm-hmm.
And our bodies are kind of the same way. We don't actually have control in the long run over our body size or shape, with the exception that when we try to shrink our bodies, then we see an upward trajectory, and then we see it grow bigger. And the reason is because we have a lot of data. Like, people will say, oh, but see, there's observational studies that say that there's higher risk for these chronic diseases when people are in bigger bodies. So it must be the bigger body. But a lot of those don't take into consideration the effect of discrimination on those bodies, the stress. And it's not just the stress of like living in a body that size, but living in maybe some of the environments that are leading to a bigger body, or not having healthcare. Like, we don't often control for, did you have access to healthcare? And again, not to say that bigger bodies are not healthy, but to say, because if you don't get healthcare, you're not noticing maybe some of these progressive diseases that are happening until it becomes very extreme. And then we say, oh, look, it's because you're in that body. No, it's not because you're in that body, because there's plenty of people who are in smaller bodies who also get this condition, but don't, like, maybe they get it noticed earlier, so they get treatment differently, right? Or because when you come into the doctor's office, they look at you and say, oh, we better run some tests, instead of saying, you better lose some weight, right? So I think there's a difference in looking at research and saying this is a causal relationship when it doesn't show a cause. That's a correlation. And a correlation means things that happen together, mm-hmm. not because one caused the other one to happen. And that's very important to pull apart and say, what kind of study are we looking at? It doesn't prove that somebody in this body develops this because of their body, right? We didn't prove that at all. We're just saying we're noticing a pattern. And we notice the pattern in other places too. It's just that, which pattern are we looking at? What part of the data are we looking at, right? Mm-hmm. The piece about the research around weight loss, when we look at studies that go past that 3 to 5 year mark, because a lot of studies, they'll stop 6 months, 3 years, 5 years, and they're like, great, weight loss successful. And then when you look at what happens after that point, sometimes they stop the study because people are gaining weight, and then they just say, oh, well, clearly you didn't follow the instructions. But it's not always that. Sometimes it's just our body responds, because our body defends the weight it wants to be at. So over time, we're going to try to go back to that weight that we're comfortable at in our bodies, right? And if we've been starving our bodies, or if we've been overworking, or if we have restriction, our bodies don't know that there's McDonald's and all these other foods around us all over the place. Our bodies just know we didn't get enough to eat, so we better save it. And so then every time we get something to eat, our body's going to be like, okay, I'm going to save this for later because there's famine coming, right? And we're training our bodies to say there's famine coming. And so we're eating, we're holding on to this. And until we let go of that restriction around what we eat, there's just going to be this upward trajectory, like, because we're weight cycling, right? We lose some weight, we gain it. We lose some weight, we gain it. Even if your weight doesn't go up, even if you're staying the same average, you're kind of going like this, that's linked with worse health outcomes, shorter lifespan than when you just have a stable weight. So there's a phrase, you can't tell someone's health from across the room, meaning like you can't look at somebody and say whether they're healthy or not, right? Like, we talk about sometimes like invisible illnesses, right? People will say, oh, there's invisible illnesses. It's pretty common when you're talking about mental illness or mental health in general, or some of the internal chronic diseases and conditions that we have. It's the same thing with something that, as a medical community, as a society, we've said, you know, is a problem, because it's not that smaller body that we've idealized. When we say, oh, look, it's a problem, but it's not really a problem. It's just a different body, right? It's just a different body. And it's like saying that somebody who's taller is going to have, that's a problem because you're not shorter, you're not the average height. That doesn't make sense, right? We're not going to try to shrink them to make them smaller.
So body fat, Shelley, is not, is there a such thing as excessive body fat then?
Again, medicalized, yes. There's more and more research that's showing, no, that it's not the biggest indicator. And even if it is, what are we going to do about it, right? Like, you may not have control over that situation. It's like saying, well, but just because, like, okay, so think about genetic, other conditions that are genetic, right? Like, or even saying like, well, if somebody is a man, they have more heart disease risk until a certain point, which is usually menopause for women, then they become equal in terms of heart disease risk. So there's, you can't really change that disease risk completely, right? Because that's just something that is there. So we're going to, we can do other things that are, we talk about modifiable health risk factors and non-modifiable health risk factors. So a modifiable health risk factors is like eating more fruits and vegetables, right? We were talking about way earlier is, when we eat more fruits and vegetables, we have a better, better health outcomes, many health indicators. When we don't eat as many fruits and vegetables, then we don't have as many, good outcomes, right? So that is a modifiable health risk factor. We can eat more vegetables and fruits, right? A non-modifiable risk factor might be something like weight to some extent, because you cannot, in the long term, you can't modify that. And that's beyond our control for the majority of people. The research is somewhere around like that 3% of people might be successful long term, but for the 97% of us, that isn't going to be the case, right? And so for 97% of the people, this is not a modifiable risk factor.
And why is it not modifiable? Because it's just like a natural thing. Our body's going to put on more weight?
Yeah, because it's going to fiercely defend the weight it wants to be at that point in time. And if you try to shrink it, it's going to bring that back and then plus more because it thinks there's famine, right? Like, so we're going to defend against famine because food is a basic need. We need it to survive. And so all of our instincts are going to be for that survival, right? So we're going to want to eat more. We're going to have more cravings when we restrict our food more because our body is like, hey, no, I need to eat, right? I'm not getting enough of what I need. So I'm going to want to eat. There's a biological drive to eat food, right? And then at the same time, if we're not getting enough, because we have basic processes that happen in our bodies, no matter how much food we're eating, right? And our metabolism, which is the rate that we process and use our energy from our foods, can change, can be modified by our body. And so sometimes what will happen is if we're not eating enough food, our body will be like, oh, okay, I need to hold on to all of this food, which means I can't use as much energy. So it slows that process of using energy way down, which means we're holding on to more of the energy. We're storing more of it as fat. We're trying to conserve our resources because they're scarce, right? And if that doesn't work, we'll start breaking down our muscle tissue and we'll start breaking down, you know, the organs and things like that. Like when you see people who have been trying to diet for a really long time, you start seeing this like breakdown in tissues because your body's using those to fuel your life because it needs fuel and you're not giving it enough, right?
So what about the people? Because I know people that, well, first of all, let's just talk about diabetes. In the African American community and even my family, diabetes, it's like a lot of people in my family have diabetes. A lot of people in my family are overweight. That has to be connected to diet, right? That's not something that's inherited. I mean, how else would you get diabetes if it's not?
You can inherit. So there's a lot of conditions that have
Let me just genetic Shelley, their eating habits are not good.
Okay. So it's not one or the other, right? Like you can have a condition that runs in your family, so your risk is higher. Statistically speaking, your risk is higher, right? And then you can also have the modifiable, because you can't change your genetics. Not like your family history of genetics, right? You cannot change that part, but you can change the modifiable pieces, how you eat, how you approach your food. If you say that you can't have sugar, again, it's going to be more likely that you're going to eat more sugar, right? So how do we approach this from a gentle perspective? How do we change that relation with food so that we can bring in the gentle nutrition? And we can say, oh, carbohydrates are one of the major things that we look at because diabetes is a condition where we can't process our carbohydrates quite as well.
Right.
So what do we do with that? And it's not to say we can't have carbohydrates because we still need carbohydrates, right? So and to stimulate some of the insulin production inside our bodies, we actually need the carbohydrates. So what do we do with that information? Okay, how do we bring that into what you know and how you eat and how you live and all these kinds of things? That's where that weight neutral diabetes care can come in, where we say it doesn't, you know, we're not looking to shrink your body. We're looking to change some of these factors that are associated with better health. We're looking to change some of these factors that are associated with, you know, less binging, less feeling out of control, better blood sugar control, right? And it doesn't necessarily mean that you can't do other, that you can't do other health approaches as well. Like, for example, saying like, oh yeah, sometimes people will need medication in addition to dietary changes, in addition to moving, in addition to, you know, having more self-compassion and less stress because stress raises their blood sugar. So things like that, like, okay, are we addressing those kinds of things as well? Right. It's not a scorecard. And I think that's one of those things is like, when we're talking about chronic disease, sometimes people are like, well, I should have done better. I should have eaten better. And so now I have to go on medication because I didn't. But there are many people who go on medication eating quote unquote perfectly according to the doctors, and they still have to go on medication. It's not because necessarily because of what we're eating. It's not because, you know, exactly because we didn't move enough. It's not because we're in a certain body size or shape. It might just be because this is what our body is doing right now. This is the state of our health right now, because this is a condition that, you know, we need to treat in other ways. It's like food. When we talk about food as medicine, I agree and I disagree with that statement. Like, it's not just about the food. It's not like food is this magical cure-all for every possible condition. I mean, when we bring in self-compassion, it's not like we just say like, oh, well, when you sleep enough, like sleep is this magical cure-all. When we sleep enough, everything else, you know, just falls into place. Mm-hmm. No, there's still other things. Like, you still have to get up and go to work, right? You still have to do other things. Like, it doesn't just happen. So it's this idea of like, let's look holistically at your life, not just at one aspect of it, and then beat ourselves up for, you know, maybe something else is still happening, or I still have to address it in another way. That's okay. We are complex people.
Right.
And it's okay that our approach to our health matches that and has multifactorial, you know, pieces in this one big approach to our health, right?
So I think, yeah, I think, and I'm sorry, there are cats in my backyard and they're always so interesting to they just catch my, they're like running across the yard. But I think that it, one of the key words you've just said is holistic and really taking into account every aspect of our lives, because I feel like if you are, let's say that you're eating more than you feel that you should be eating, and that you're not at the body size that you want to be at, I think those are symptoms of something deeper happening within you. I think that there's some type of feeling of lack, like lack of self-worth, lack of you feel like you're not good enough, something that you're not really addressing. The relationship with yourself is not in alignment. And when you're not in relationship with yourself and not fully compassionate with yourself, and I just talked to you the other day about someone that was, or just had an interview, posted an interview about self-love, which a lot of us kind of poo-poo. But then you're going to have all these other symptoms, because then you're going to start compensating for all this lack with the eating, or the overeating, or the undereating, or whatever it is, or the obsessing over the body. And so it's not necessarily that if you are, not everyone who is overweight is unhealthy. That's true. But I think we need to be honest with ourselves and say, okay, I'm overweight. Is there something happening within me? Is this a symptom of something that I am not confronting, some type of spiritual internal issue that I'm not confronting? And if I perhaps heal the pain within me, then that will start to expand out to the other aspects of my life, so that I'll begin to heal my relationship with food. I begin to heal my relationship with my body, right? It's a very specific internal issue with each person, but I think it takes a lot of honesty and integrity to really get to the root of it.
Yeah. And I would say even then, like, a healed relationship with food and ourselves and our body doesn't necessarily mean a skinny body, right? Mm-hmm. So it's not to say like, oh, people who are in a bigger body aren't they don't have an appropriate relationship with food. They don't have this like internal sense of alignment and a sense of who they are. It could just be that that's the body that they're in and they have these things, right? Like, you know, maybe I'm going back to the hair example too. Like, okay, but does a healed relationship with myself mean that my hair starts to be, you know, straight because that's the idealized thing? No, it just means that I am more okay with who I am and how my hair is. And maybe I'm not fighting it. Maybe I decide to make it straight sometimes, but also not, right? Like, but that is something that is a little bit more in our control than, I mean, temporarily than weight is. But so when we're looking at weight, again, we're not saying that it's a bad thing to be at a bigger size, or it's only allowed if, you know, if you haven't done the healing work, because then that sets up like, well, that's an indicator that you haven't done the healing work. It's not an indicator, right? It's just, that is. And maybe it's not going to be the same size you're at forever. That's fine. But let's have a neutral attitude about our body shape and size and other people's body shape and size, because that's none of our business, right? Like all those people that were attacking this person who posted, it's not their business. Health is not their business. This is a stranger. And this is none of your business, right? So just like I wouldn't want somebody commenting on my stuff, just, you know, and my health and all these comments, like, thank you. Me and my team have it, you know, have a plan for this. I appreciate your concern. This is not the appropriate way of explaining it, right? Of expressing mm-hmm. this. So that can happen in any shape or size. And, you know, just because I'm in a smaller body, I shouldn't have more right to be free from that than someone in a bigger body. Right.
Right. Yeah. And I agree. Yeah. It's not mm-hmm. because you could undereat. There are plenty of people who are underweight for various reasons. Isn't that, that's not necessarily healthy either. Yeah. It does. I think that it just really comes down to your relationship with mm-hmm. yourself. Because yeah, you could be thin and healthy. You could be bigger and healthy. If you're thin and unhealthy, or if you're big and unhealthy, then that's when you really need to, the self-awareness kicks in.
Yeah.
It's like, that's where you come in.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
As if somebody wants to change that, then that's where I come in, and it doesn't matter then at that point, the size or the shape of your body, it can inform us, right? Because there's a different lived experience, but it doesn't necessarily mean that we're going to always change that approach just because of the body, right? Mm-hmm. Of the shape of the size of the body. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But I liked what you said about, you know, it's really a matter of figuring out who you are, essentially, and like, where does that identity come from? Because a lot of what I see is in our culture, in our own sense of self, it's like performance based, and that bleeds over to the food, right? It's like, how well did I do today? How, you know, how good am I at eating healthy or meeting these goals or whatever it is? And that's not where our identity, I mean, it could be where you're taking your identity from, but like, it's not, you know, it's not the most helpful place for your identity to be rooted in.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, this has been interesting. We're like an hour and 15 minutes. So I think this is a good place to stop. And thank you so much for all of your wisdom and knowledge you've shared. And why don't you tell us where we can find you?
Yeah. You can find me at confidentnutritionnow.com. And that's my website. You'll be able to find like all the links to everywhere else from there. And I'm on social media. Again, you can find it from there. You can search, you know, Confident Nutrition and or Shelley. And you can usually pull up most of the social media accounts that way. And I really appreciated being here. This was a really fun conversation.
Yes, it was very enlightening for sure. Thank you, Shelley. I'm going to stop recording, but I'll just chat with you for a moment.
What an enlightening conversation about health and wellness and food and diet and all that stuff. So if you are interested in learning more about intuitive eating, if you're interested about learning more about Shelly and her services, then please visit her website, Confident Nutrition Now. It is in the show notes. This is a topic that affects all of us, right? Food, eating, because we all have to eat. So please visit her site. In the meantime, you can also visit zazo.com and sign up for my newsletter, because if you're interested in participating in my 5-day energy cleanse, the newsletter is where it's at. You will have information emailed to you as the event begins to unfold and launching day approaches. So please sign up for my newsletter at zazo.com. You can also follow me. I'm on social media. I'm on Facebook at Motivation to Write and Motivation to Heal. I have a Facebook group, Energy Healing with Ebony, that you can connect with me through either of those other two pages, Motivation to Write or Motivation to Heal. And you can also follow me on Instagram at Motivation to Write. Thank you so much for tuning in, and I look forward to being with you next time when I talk to another fabulous guest, and on April 18th for the 5-day energy cleanse. Okay, see you then. Bye-bye.